I'm Chuck Reese, the editor-in-chief of SalvationSouth.com. It's an online magazine that tells Southern stories of every persuasion. We have worked for the last few years with Georgia Public Broadcasting to produce the Salvation South podcast. And on this show, we put a spotlight on all things Southern, the culture, the food, the music, the ways of life, and the lesser-known histories of this complicated region we call home. And for this special two-part episode of the Salvation South podcast, we'll be playing you a selection of some of our most popular commentaries aired by GPB in the year 2025, starting with this one, which originally aired back in June. Since a half century ago, colleges and universities around the South have established centers to study the culture of our region. There's the Center for Appalachian Studies in Kentucky, the Center for the Study of the American South in North Carolina, the Center for the Study of Southern Culture in Mississippi. In this commentary, I share my thoughts about why preserving Southern folklore matters. Later this decade, we will celebrate the golden anniversary of an institution that has done much good work to help us understand the culture of the South. In 1977, down in Oxford, Mississippi, the University of Mississippi opened its Center for the Study of Southern Culture. Their goal was to document the people of this region and their culture, their literature, their food, their music, their economic situations, their stories, their folklore. Webster's Unabridged Dictionary offers two definitions of folklore. My favorite one reads like this: folklore is a comparative science that investigates the life and spirit of a people or of peoples as revealed in their traditional customs and tales. The first director of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture in Mississippi was Bill Ferris, and I've had the pleasure of getting to know him over the last decade. Bill grew up on a farm outside Vicksburg, Mississippi, and he was always fascinated by the black culture that surrounded him. The storytellers and the musicians, the blues players who made the Saturday night music, and the church choirs that made the Sunday morning music. When he was a teenager, he was dragging around a Super 8 film camera and a reel-to-reel tape deck, recording their music and stories. I've been doing a series of interviews with Bill lately about four documentary films that he released in the mid-70s before he returned to Mississippi to open that center. Even though he is in his 80s now, his excitement about collecting the folklore of the South is infectious, and he's so hopeful about what young people in our region will collect in the future. Why? Well, because unlike people of his own generation, young people don't have to drag around a carload of equipment anymore. They have everything they need to be folklorists right in their pockets, Bill says.
Technology has made every man a potential filmmaker and documenter of his or her world. And so I tell my students, you have no excuse, and start with your grandparents. We often neglect those worlds that are our own, thinking that they couldn't be as important as someone down the street. We are the stories we tell.
People like Bill Ferris figured out a long time ago that anyone who paints the South with a broad brush, claiming that all Southerners do this or believe that, is just wrong. People like Bill know there is not and never has been one South. There are 10,000 Souths. Your own story of your own life as a Southerner is one of those. Don't be afraid to tell it. After all, you have all the equipment you need right there in your pocket. If you're interested in telling your Southern story, you ought to get in touch with us at SalvationSouth.com. We'll see what we can do to help you out. To learn more about Bill Ferris and his work, scroll down this podcast feed to listen to his episode of Salvation South Deluxe titled The Blueprint, How Bill Ferris Defined Southern Folklore. I also did an extensive interview series with Dr. Ferris, marking the 50th anniversary of the release of his four quintessential documentaries on Southern culture. And you can read all of those, watch the original films, and watch our interviews on SalvationSouth.com. Next up on our year-end Salvation South commentary retrospective, there's this one from April. The occasion of April Fool's Day got me thinking about an idea that was once put forth by the great Alabama songwriter Jason Isbell. Do Southerners tell better jokes? Now, I have tried for a long time to prove that true, and in this commentary, you can hear how that worked out for me. One of the most famous Southern songwriters these days is Jason Isbell, who is from Green Hill, Alabama, an unincorporated community about halfway between Zip City and Lexington, just south of the Tennessee line. And the first song of his that really got my attention about 20 years ago was written when he was a member of another band from North Alabama, the Drive-By Truckers. The song was called Outfit. And in the chorus of that song, you hear a working-class father giving advice to his son. And one piece of that advice is,
don't worry about losing your accent. A Southern man tells better jokes.
Now, the first time I heard that lyric, I thought a truer line has never been written. Southerners do tell better jokes. But could I prove it? I started thinking about this because here we are in the first week of April, which begins, of course, with April Fool's Day. Once, while I lived in New York City, a new acquaintance heard my accent and asked where I was from. Georgia, I replied. He said, I invited a guy from Georgia to a party one time, and he brought a ladder. Why would he do that? I asked. Because I told him the drinks were on the house. I'd been had. It got me pretty good. Of course, that put me on a quest to find jokes to put down New Yorkers, but honestly, I can't say that I found enough to confirm Jason Isbell's assertion. I did enjoy myself, though, when a comedian from Roswell, Georgia, named David Cross, moved to New York City while I was living there. He had a great joke about trying to get a library card in Manhattan. He'd say, New York's such a wonderful city, although I was at the library and the guy was very rude. I said, I'd like a library card. He said, you have to prove you're a citizen of New York. So I stabbed him. The truth, alas, is that while I believe in my bones Jason Isbell was right, that Southerners do tell better jokes, I cannot prove it. Southerners probably tell better jokes about each other than other people tell about us. But I really can't go much farther than that. I'll just say this. If a friend invited you over for dinner on April Fool's Day, I hope you were smart enough to take a tiny sip instead of a big gulp from that sweet tea he offered you. Because at my house on April Fool's Day, that icy pitcher of Southern table wine, that sweet tea, it's salted. Come see us anytime at SalvationSouth.com. This next commentary originally aired on March 4th of 2025, which was Ash Wednesday. Now, that day, of course, marks the beginning of Lent, a season of fasting and reflection. Ash Wednesday is also, of course, the day after Mardi Gras. In this commentary, I'll give a brief history of how the South's celebration of Mardi Gras reach back to ancient times. Happy Wednesday. I have a question for you. Do you have a hangover this morning? I ask only because yesterday was Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras Day. While Mardi Gras parades are not common here in Georgia, they roll through cities of all sizes in Louisiana, from New Orleans to Little Mamou in Cajun country. I have often published the work of a wonderful writer named Richard Murph. Many years back, he sent me a piece about the history of Mardi Gras celebrations in Louisiana. And a few lines he wrote in that story, trying to suss out the real purpose of Mardi Gras, have stuck with me. Mardi Gras, Richard wrote, and I quote, is not a celebration for the sake of being drunk. It is a feast before the coming famine, a celebration of life in the face of approaching death. The body will die, but what of it? We are in God's hands. Richard was pointing to a fact no one can deny. Death is inevitable. So Mardi Gras reminds us not to, under any circumstances, neglect the joy of the life we have. Now, the history of the carnival season travels back to ancient times, celebrations held in various cultures to greet springtime. And when Christianity arrived a couple thousand years ago, carnival season became tied to the church calendar. It begins on January 6th, the church's Feast of the Epiphany, which celebrates the three wise men bringing gifts to the infant Jesus in Bethlehem. And it ends 8 or 9 weeks later with Ash Wednesday, the beginning of Lent, that 40-day season of repentance and fasting, also known as today. If you attend a Christian church, you might have a cross of ashes on your forehead right now. And you've probably decided what you intend to give up, chocolate or social media, road rage, whatever, for the next 40 days. And like me, you might or might not succeed. And I remember Ash Wednesday, the first time I was in New Orleans for Mardi Gras, watching hundreds of people walking by bleary-eyed, ashes on their foreheads, beginning their season of repentance. Or maybe Lent is a celebration of a different sort. Another thing I learned from my friend Richard was that the first North American celebration of Mardi Gras happened in 1705, about 30 miles north of Mobile, Alabama, at Fort Louis de la Louisiane, the first capital of the French colony of Louisiana. The year before, an outbreak of yellow fever had killed 20% of the French colonists there. Theoretically, Richard wrote, the party was for Lent. But in reality, it was an aren't we glad to still be alive type get-together. Carnival, my friend Richard wrote, is a celebration of the elation we feel, not when things are great, but when we survive as the world comes unhinged. Y'all come see us anytime at SalvationSouth.com for stories of the South and its weird, wonderful history. We're looking back on the most notable Salvation South commentaries aired by GPB Radio in 2025. This next one is from September. Now, that month is typically known as harvest time for many crops, and in particular for North Georgia's many apple orchards. I happen to grow up in our state's apple capital, L&J, and in my opinion, the best apple of all requires waiting until the first 2 weeks of October. And I'll tell you all about it in this commentary. My dear wife, Stacy, loves southern summertime when it's hottest, when the temperatures are in the 90s and the humidity is too. She says it feels like a warm hug. Me? I favor the fall. I love it when autumn turns the hillsides into abstract paintings. Because I grew up in L&J, the apple capital of Georgia, I also prefer the fall because folks harvest apples then. The picking begins in the middle of August, but the apple I love best doesn't come off the trees until October. That apple is called the winesap, specifically the stamen winesap. The winesap was first documented in 1804, when a man named Samuel Coles in Moorestown, New Jersey, developed a cultivar he thought was perfect for making apple cider. Someone tried it and declared it tasted like, and I quote, wine sop. Thus the name. In the mid-1800s, the wine sap traveled west with settlers. In Kansas, a horticulturist named Dr. Joseph Stamen experimented until he achieved what he thought was the perfect wine sap. In 1875, if I had been with Dr. Stamen in Kansas for that first harvest, my response would have been, yes, sir, That is the appliest apple you could possibly hope for. The Stamen Wines app is firm. It snaps when you bite it. I like that. But what I like most is the flavor. Sweet and tart in perfect balance. That combination of firmness and flavor suits any purpose. It's great for eating, great for making cider, and make a cobbler from it and you will ascend into culinary heaven. We will put my Stamen Winesap cobbler recipe on the Georgia Public Broadcasting website for you, and come the first weekly edition of Salvation South magazine in October, it'll be on our homepage. But here are the basics. Number one, drive to LJ, Georgia, sometime in the first 2 weeks of October. Find an apple house. Buy at least half a peck of Stamen Winesaps. That'll be about 5 or 6 pounds. You'll need 3 pounds for your cobbler, and you can eat the rest. Back home, you will peel and dice them. Then mix them with lemon juice, vanilla extract, brown sugar, ground cinnamon, ground ginger, nutmeg, mace, and sea salt. You'll cook all of that in butter. Then you'll make a batter out of white sugar, flour, baking powder, salt, and whole milk. You'll pour that batter into even more melted butter. Then you will put your cooked winesaps on top of the butter and batter, and then you bake. Fall isn't fall to me until I get my first taste of that. And I promise you, it's worth all the trouble. Come see us anytime at SalvationSouth.com. We've almost reached the end of part one of our retrospective of the most popular commentaries aired by Georgia Public Broadcasting in 2025. We have only one to go, and this one is from all the way back in January. When the great Southern chef, television host, and cookbook author Natalie Dupree passed away that month at age 85, I remembered my first discovery of her. When I was in my 20s, I was living in New York City, and I felt awful hungry for Southern food. When I first moved to New York City, I was fresh out of college, a little homesick, and I discovered that it was awfully hard to find decent fried chicken, much less an edible biscuit in the Big Apple. And the longer I lived there, the more I missed Southern cooking. But after a couple of years up there, a TV show that helped me out started running on PBS. It was called New Southern Cooking with Natalie Dupree.
Hello, I'm Natalie Dupree. Welcome to New Southern Cooking today.
And I've been without Natalie Dupree, Southern cooking might never have won the global admiration that it has today. But the best thing about Natalie Dupree was how deeply she understood an essential truth. That cooking nourishes not only the body, but also the soul. And through her 14 books and over 300 episodes of various cooking shows, she communicated that understanding with great humor and humility. Dupree was a founder in 1999 of the Southern Foodways Alliance. The SFA invites, in the words of another founder, the late Nashville writer John Edgerton, women and men, black and white, one and all, to sit down and break bread together around one great Southern table. The common table, in the SFA's eyes, provided a place where Southerners could seek racial reconciliation. A quarter century later, the SFA is still doing that good work. I've been friends with Melissa Hall, one of the SFA's co-directors, for a long time. And after Natalie Dupree passed away, I called Melissa. I wanted to ask her to recall what Natalie did for the SFA, and she told me about Natalie's abiding belief that food could bring different Southerners together in community when nothing else might be able to do that. But Melissa also told me what Natalie Dupree did for her.
When I got married, it was Natalie's cookbooks and Natalie's presence on public television that got me through probably the first 4 years of my life as like a person who makes supper every night and a person who starts like hosting things. And so I assume that there are hundreds of thousands of me's out there, women who Natalie taught them what they know about how to hostess and how to cook and how to be gracious using the kitchen as your platform.
There is an old American folk song about the hope to eat at the welcome table some of these days. So Natalie Dupree will be missed not only for her recipes or her books or her humor. She will be missed because she had that gift, the ability to create a welcome table and a heart that was big enough to invite everybody to gather around it. Come see us anytime at SalvationSouth.com. That wraps up part one of our year-end retrospective featuring my most notable radio commentaries of 2025. If you like what you hear, scroll down this podcast feed to hear all of the commentaries from almost 4 years of working with Georgia Public Broadcasting. And you can also listen to the Salvation South Deluxe episode. That's a series of longer shows which go deeper into topics of Southern interest, like this one about my hometown of Clarkston, Georgia, which for a half century has welcomed refugees from 150 different ethnic groups around the world.
We love living in Clarkston. Like, there's really no other place in the world I would want to live. It really is like a peaceful community. It is diverse.
Or this one, on the traveling bubble of happiness that has grown up around a rock band from Athens, Georgia, known as Widespread Panic.
When you have such a beautiful audience that is so, you know, open to anything that the musicians want to try, that makes the audience actually part of the music.
Be sure to give those a listen, and don't forget to leave a review. Those reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts really help us out. And finally, as always, you can visit SalvationSouth.com 24 hours a day for more Southern stories than you can shake a stick at. We've got journalism, narrative nonfiction, poetry, essays, memoir. We even show short films. Please visit us. I'm Chuck Reese. Thanks for listening.